screeched loudly and with obvious satisfaction.
"Welcome to civilization, Gunny," Lieutenant Hart said, a touch of laughter in his voice.
"Who's he?"
"Lieutenant Hart works for General Pickering," McCoy said. "Watch out for him. He used to be a cop." Zimmerman took another beer from the bucket and flipped the top off expertly with his K-bar.
"And the swabby?"
he asked, either as if he believed Lieutenant Lewis was deaf and could not hear him, or simply didn't care whether he did or not. "He's going to give us a ride in a submarine."
"Huh? A ride to where?"
"We're going into the Philippines."
"Why?"
"There's an army officer there, and some guys from the 4th Marines who didn't surrender. We're going to take them radios, a little gear and medicine, see what kind of help they need, and figure out how to get it to them."
"We? You and me?"
"You and me, a staff sergeant named Koffler, and Captain Robert B. Macklin."
"Macklin? Not the same son of a bitch who tried to fuck us, you and Lieutenant Sessions in particular, in China?"
"One and the same."
"You're working for him?"
"No. He's just going along."
"I'm surprised somebody hadn't shot that bastard by now,"
Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman said. He took a long pull at his fresh bottle of beer and belched again.
"Good beer," he said. "Where are we going now?"
"I thought you could probably use a steak, maybe with fresh eggs. Hart knows a good place."
"What I really could use is a place to take a good dump," Zimmerman said. "How far is this place?"
7. Office of the Military Governor of Mindanao, Cagayan de Oro, Misamis, Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 1450 hours, 8 December, 1942.
"There has been a development in the Fertig matter," Lieutenant Colonel Tangi Kisho said to Brigadier General Kurokawa Kenzo, "which we feel should be brought to the General's attention."
General Kurokawa nodded. Lieutenant Colonel Tange turned to Captain Matsuo Saikaku, who handed him a single sheet of paper. Tange handed this to General Kurokawa. He read it, and then looked at Tange, waiting for an explanation.
"As the General can see, Signals Intelligence has broken the simple substitution code used by the Americans in Australia in their last message to Fertig. The message reads, 'We'll see you soon. Signature, killer.'"
"And your interpretation of the significance of this, Colonel?"
"After some thought, I have come to believe that Captain Saikaku's interpretation, while it might be in error, is one that we cannot afford to ignore."
"And what is your interpretation, Captain Saikaku?"
General Kurokawa asked, somewhat impatiently.
"Sir, I believe we must proceed on the assumption that the Americans will soon attempt to infiltrate Mindanao and make contact with Fertig."
"Expand,"
Kurokawa ordered.
"It is my analysis, sir," Saikaku replied, "that Fertig is now accepted by the American command in Australia as legitimate, and that they are now going to attempt to establish physical contact with him."
"For what purpose, and how?"
"If I were the American commander, General, I would first try to get in place a sophisticated communication set, an encryption system that we will not be able to break as quickly as the primitive one they are now using. And since I don't believe they will be able to send him much in the way of supplies, I believe they will send him gold, and perhaps some medicine and small quantities of small arms and ammunition."
"How? By air?"
"I think by submarine, sir. I don't believe the risk to American long-range aircraft, what they have available is the Boeing bomber primarily, would be justified by the amount of cargo they can carry. I also think that they would be unwilling to send a surface vessel, which would almost certainly be detected by our air patrols. That leaves only submarines. As I am sure the General will remember, the Americans used them successfully until almost the day Corregidor fell."
"Where?"
"This, of course, is a guess, sir, but I would say somewhere on the eastern shore of the island."
"They are succeeding, aren't they?" General Kurokawa said.
"Sir?"
"In forcing us to divert personnel and equipment to watch for them. That's one of the objectives of irregular forces, to cause their enemy to expend resources they otherwise would not have to expend."
"Yes, sir, I'm afraid that's true," Saikaku said.
"There must be several thousand miles of shoreline on Mindanao.
Obviously, we don't have the aircraft or the people on the ground to patrol every foot of it, waiting for a submarine which may or may not attempt to put people ashore. So what would you suggest we do, Captain Saikaku?
I have given that some thought, General, and Colonel Tange has been kind enough to offer me his counsel. I have prepared a map on which are marked what are, in my judgment, the 10 most likely places where a submarine would attempt to put people ashore. May I show it to the General?
Kurikawa nodded, and Saikaku laid the map on his desk.
Very interesting, Kurikawa said after examining it. But we don't have the forces available to patrol all these beaches.
I am aware of that, sir, Saikaku said. I suggested to Colonel Tange that we patrol these marked areas on a random basis, using aircraft and small 3 or 4 man patrols on the beaches themselves.
That's the best you can do? Kurikawa asked, almost sadly.
Our best hope, General, is the interception and rapid decryption of the message Australia will send to Furtick, telling him when and where to expect the submarine.
Unless, of course, the Americans don't send such a message and simply put their people ashore to find Furtick by themselves.
We must accept that as a possibility, General, Tange said. But still, it is my respectful recommendation that we increase our shore patrol efforts on the eastern shore.
General Kurikawa considered that for a moment.
See my operations officer, Tange, and work out a plan with him. Bring it to me for my approval.
Yes, sir.
And you, Saikaku, make sure that if there is a message from Australia announcing the arrival of a submarine, we intercept it.
Yes, sir.
Part 14. 1. Water Lily Cottage, Brisbane, Australia, 2105 hours, 9 December 1942. Major Han Song-du, Signal Corps, USA, muttered an obscene and vulgar word not ordinarily in his vocabulary, rose from the paper-cluttered dining room table, went to the sideboard, picked up a bottle of famous grouse, poured an inch and a half into a water glass, and drank it straight down. Sitting at the table were Captains Robert B. Macklin and Edward Sessions, USMC, Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, Lieutenants K.R. McCoy and John Marston Moore, USMCR, and Sergeant Stephen Koffler, USMC. Han turned to them, met McCoy's eyes, and announced in his thick Boston accent,
"Just between thee and me, Kenneth, my lad, when I was recruited to apply the ancient and noble art of cipher to the detriment of our enemy, this was not what I thought they had in mind.
Why don't we just give up? We've been at this for hours, and all we've come up with is that bullshit," McCoy said, pointing at the typewriter on the table in front of Koffler. "And hand me that bottle when you're through with it."
"The boss said come up with a way to communicate with Furtick," Lieutenant John Marston Moore began, to be interrupted by Captain Macklin's bark,
"General officer on the deck!"
Both McCoy and Sessions flashed Macklin a look of mingled disbelief and contempt. This was Water Lily Cottage, not headquarters Paris Island. But their response, and that of the others, was Pavlovian. There was the sound of chair legs scraping on the floor as everyone started to rise to their feet and come to attention.
"As you were, gentlemen," Brigadier General Fleming Pickering said as he and Colonel Jack, NMI, Stecker walked into the room.
"Keep your seats."
Pickering and Stecker found seats at the table.
"Pass him the bottle, Pluto," Pickering ordered. "And when he's had what I'm sure is a well-deserved taste, he can explain exactly what bullshit it is you've come up with."
"Sorry, sir, I didn't expect you back so early," McCoy said.
"Obviously," Pickering said. "Colonel Stecker and I just took $11 of L. and Madam L. Supremo's money at bridge. If you have the bad manners to do that, you are not invited for post-game drinks."
Pluto chuckled, then walked to where Koffler was sitting before a typewriter, jerked a sheet of paper from the platen, added several other sheets to it, and laid them before Pickering and Stecker.
I'm embarrassed to show you this, sir, he said. "Koffler just made a clean copy. Most of it's Moore's idea."
"Thanks a lot, Pluto," Moore said.
"I didn't mean that the way it sounded, Johnny. Sorry. None of us had any better ideas, sir, and this just may work."
McCoy snorted. Pickering read the top sheet of paper and then handed it to Stecker.
Message 1. Hour. O-O-O-O. Use what Navy will find in heaven as simple substitution code.
Okay, John, Pickering said. Explain this to me. Start at the beginning and explain everything carefully. Colonel Stecker and I are old men, and we don't absorb things as quickly as you bright young fellows.
We were about halfway through this, General, Lieutenant John Marston Moore said, when Pluto brought up that we have to presume the Japanese, A, are listening to our traffic, and B, by now have broken the Ludmilla-Zhivkov-Zanesville simple substitution code, and thus, C, we need another one.
Okay, Pickering said. So tell me, what will the Navy find in heaven?
If the Army and the Navy ever look on heaven's scene, Captain Ed Sessions said, they will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines, he continued, from the Marine hymn.
Jesus H. Christ, Colonel Stecker said, in mingled disbelief and disgust. That's the best you so-called experts can come up with?
Yes, sir, Colonel, sir, McCoy agreed. My thoughts exactly.
With respect, sir, Pluto said. Moore said we needed something that any Marine would know, and that would not be immediately familiar to the Japanese. This meets that criteria. We tested it on 9 of the Marines in Townsville, Joe Howard in the hospital in Melbourne, and Colonel Mitchell at Sweepo.
Since you obviously couldn't tell them why you were asking, those must have been interesting conversations, Pickering said with a chuckle.
They were, sir. But all but one Marine knew almost immediately what was meant.
Who didn't?
Colonel Mitchell, sir, Moore said. He asked me if I had been drinking and said that he intended to bring the conversation to your attention.
It sounds as if you were, Stecker said, pointing to the quart of famous grouse in front of McCoy.
How many bottles of that stuff have you people been into?
Take it easy, Jack, Pickering said. If it works, don't laugh at it.
Okay, we now have a fresh, simple substitution code. What's hour 0000 mean?
The sunfish will surface 30 minutes after nightfall, the day before the landing is attempted, sir, Pluto said, and transmit message 1. The clock will start to run, hour 0000, when receipt of message 1 is acknowledged. If you'll look at the second sheet, message 2.
Message 1 will be transmitted from the sunfish, is that what you're saying? Pickering asked as he read the second sheet of paper.
Message 2. Hour 0200. They will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines, followed by 10 seemingly meaningless five-letter groupings.
Lieutenant Lewis suggested, sir, and we're agreed it's a good idea, that message 1 will first be transmitted from the sunfish, and then, when the radio stations here and at Pearl hear it, they will be alerted to listen for it. It will be repeated by them. The greater strength of their signals will more or less guarantee reception by Fertig.
If Fertig happens to be listening, McCoy said.
The possibility, of course, exists, Ken, that they will not be listening, Pluto said. But I think they will be.
And if not, Pickering said, handing Stecker message 2, if you don't get acknowledgement?
We'll keep trying. The stations at Pearl Harbor and here, not the sunfish, on an hourly basis until midnight, Pluto said. I really think we'll get through.
And if you do, Pickering asked.
2 hours after we get acknowledgement, we send message 2. That gives them 2 hours to figure out what the Marine hymn substitution is.
Speaking of which, Stecker said, will somebody please translate this for me?
This is where it really gets far out, Colonel, McCoy said.
Who is Lily? What is this? Stecker asked.
The Marine hymn substitution code doesn't have a K or an O, Colonel, Moore said. We are using an L when a K is needed. It's the next letter and a consonant. Where an O is required, we are using a U. We think the substitution will be self-evident.
Right, McCoy said sarcastically. The substitution will be self-evident. These guys are hiding out in the boondocks, and we want to play word games with them.
If you can't handle the whiskey, McCoy, leave it alone, Pickering snapped. What we're trying to do here is keep you alive.
He was immediately sorry, not because of his own words, they needed to be said, but because of the look of approval on Captain Macklin's face.
Message 2, Colonel, Moore said, reads,
Killer and Ernie will eat beans 30 miles south this morning.
Eat beans? What does that mean? South of what?
Stecker asked.
This doesn't make any sense to me.
You weren't here, Jack, when Lewis and I went over the charts, Pickering said. Where's that chart, Pluto?
Right here, sir,
Pluto said, and pushed the chart across the table. Show him, Lewis, Pickering said.
Aye, aye, sir, Lewis said.
Colonel, I suggested to General Pickering that the best place to try to land McCoy and party would be on the east coast of Mindanao. I've sailed those interior waters, Jack, Pickering said. They are not among the best charted waters in the world. We don't want the sunfish running submerged into an uncharted reef or shoal. The waters to the east of Mindanao are safest.
You'll notice, Colonel, Lewis said, pointing, the subsurface terrain here. The Philippine Trench, with depths to about 9,000 fathoms, is only about 75 miles offshore. The 6,000-fathom curve is 60 miles offshore, the 4,000 curve 35 miles offshore, the 2,000 20 miles offshore, and the 200-fathom curve runs almost along the shoreline.
I don't know what that means, Stecker said. According to Lewis, Jack, a submarine skipper is perfectly happy when he has 100 fathoms under his keel, Pickering said. That's 600 feet. In my experience, and from what Lewis tells me in the navies, when you have fathom curve lines like these, there is little chance of encountering an underwater obstacle.
Even in a submerged submarine? Stecker asked.
We have a 200-fathom depth all along here, Pickering replied. 1,200 feet. If a sub runs at 300 feet, he's got 900 feet under his keel.
Okay, Stecker said.
Sir, if you will look here, Lewis said, pointing at the chart again, you will see the 200-fathom curve just about touches the shore at this point, which is 30 miles south of a village fortunately called Boston.
Boston beans, right? Stecker asked.
That's the idea, sir, Lewis said. The sunfish can sail submerged to within a couple of 100 yards of the coastline and still have at least 100 fathoms under her keel.
A couple of 100 yards? Stecker asked doubtfully. How are you going to keep from running into the shoreline?
Sonar, sir, Lewis said. It stands for sound navigation and ranging. The sunfish has it aboard, sir. She'll know when she's getting in close.
And you think Fertig will understand this Boston beans connection? Stecker asked dubiously.
We tested that, too, sir, Pluto replied.
How? Pickering asked.
McCoy and I went to the Sweepo Officers Club, Sessions said. We asked 10 officers at the bar the first thing that came to mind when they heard the word beans. We got 6 Boston, or Boston baked, and 1 each Lima, Snap, and Navy.
You really did your research, didn't you? Pickering said, chuckling.
That's 9, Stecker said. You said you asked 10 officers.
And now that you mention it, Colonel, McCoy said, we also got 1 fart.
6 out of 10 responses with a Boston connection, sir, Pluto said very quickly, seems more than reasonable. I mean, I think we can presume Fertig will immediately discount Lima, Snap, and Navy.
1 fart, huh? Pickering said, and laughed.
What if you can't get an acknowledgement from Fertig? Stecker asked.
There's some argument about that, sir, Pluto said. One being that the sunfish should repeat the operation the next day and the day after that, if necessary. The other argument is to put McCoy and party ashore just before daylight anyway and attempt to contact Fertig by other means.
Argument 2 came from McCoy, right? Pickering said.
Yes, sir,
McCoy said.
All right, McCoy, Pickering said. Tell us why you're not happy with this.
The more complicated something is, the more things can go wrong, McCoy said. There's too much if in this for me. I'd much prefer to do this simply. The 4 of us go ashore without doing anything to make the Japanese nervous. We find Fertig.
How are you going to do that?
Zimmerman says that the Filipinos will know where he is, and I agree with them. And they will know we've come ashore.
Pickering nodded.
Where is he, by the way?
He kept falling asleep, so I sent him home, McCoy replied, and went on. We'll have good radios and a real code with us, so as soon as we find Fertig, we get in direct touch with the submarine. It's likely we can do it in 5 days. I think the sub can hang around that long, surfacing only for a few minutes to listen to the radio. Then we tell the sub where and when to meet us.
Pickering shrugged. This is not a democracy, and this is not going to be decided by a vote. But I'd like to hear what everybody thinks about this, he said, and pointed at Koffler. Starting with you, Steve, we'll work our way up the ranks.
General, I'm with McCoy, Koffler said. I don't want a bunch of excited Japs running around looking for us, particularly since we don't know where to hide. And these messages are... No offense, Major, or you either, Mr. Moore. A little screwy.
He is just a boy, not old enough to vote. But on the other hand, he knows more about keeping alive on a Japanese-occupied island than anybody in the room. I guess you're next, John, aren't you? Pickering said.
I disagree with Steve about the messages being screwy, Moore said. Fertig and the people with him are desperate. Their minds will be at a high pitch. They're intelligent. I think they will almost immediately comprehend the messages. The great unknown, which worries me, is how quickly the Japanese will be able to decipher both messages, and what that will mean. Steve's "a bunch of excited Japanese running around" worries me, even if they can't make the Boston Bean connection.
That worries me, too. Which of you is senior? Pickering asked, pointing to Lewis and Macklin.
I believe I am, sir, Lewis said.
That makes you next, Captain Macklin, Pickering said.
Sir, when I'm out of my depth, I try not to offer an opinion, Macklin said in a flat voice.
Let me put it this way, then. How do you feel about going ashore without having made contact with Fertig?
I'm a Marine officer, General. I'll go where I'm told to go.
He has no interest in any of this. Why is he disinterested? There are two answers to that. Either he has closed his mind to the possibility that he's going to find himself paddling up to an enemy-held shore in a rubber boat, or, and I think this is what it is, he doesn't think he's going. I can't believe he'd try to miss the boat on this, but stranger things have happened.
Lewis?
General, since I'm not going ashore, I'd rather not offer an opinion, Chambers D. Lewis said.
Who's right, Pluto or McCoy? Pickering asked impatiently.
I would have to align myself with Major Han, sir, Lewis said.
Okay. You're next, Ed.
I think I'd go with Koffler and McCoy, sir, Sessions said.
Jack, Pickering said. We already know what Pluto thinks.
McCoy,
Stecker said. Pickering nodded.
This places me in a very awkward position. The people I admire most in this room disagree with me, including the only people who know what it is to be on an enemy-held island and to have, what did Koffler say? A bunch of excited Japs running around looking for them. But they're wrong. If you put a box around Mindanao, it would be 450 miles on a side. We don't know where Fertig is inside that box, and we certainly can't risk asking him where he is until we deliver to him a code the Japanese can't break in an hour. And if McCoy and his people go ashore and are never heard from again, hell will freeze over before we can mount another mission. MacArthur will consider himself vindicated, and Donovan will gleefully announce that if he had been in charge, the operation would have worked.
This is what we're going to do, Pickering announced. We will proceed with what Pluto and Moore have come up with. The sunfish will surface 30 miles south of Boston 1/2 hour after nightfall, 23 December. Message 1 will be sent at that time. Sunfish will wait 10 minutes for acknowledgement. If no acknowledgement is received, she will submerge. She shall resurface at hourly intervals 10 minutes past the hour, the last surfacing to be at 00:10, 24 December.
That's Christmas Eve, Captain Macklin said, shocked.
Merry Christmas, Sergeant Koffler, McCoy said.
Which is, of course, Christmas Eve, Pickering said. Whether or not there is acknowledgement, the sunfish will surface again 30 minutes before sunrise, which will occur at 5:29, and offload McCoy, Zimmerman, Koffler, and Captain Macklin. They will carry with them only personal small arms, communications radios, the codes, and a token amount of gold and medicine. The sunfish will remain on the surface until there is word that the landing party has made it safely to the beach.
Or until a Jap airplane starts dropping bombs on it, McCoy said, whichever comes first.
That's quite enough thank you from you, Mr. McCoy, Pickering said. But he was unable to restrain a smile. As I was saying, before Charlie McCarthy here ran off at the mouth,
The sunfish will remain on the surface until the landing party is ashore.
A highly popular radio program of the era featured ventriloquist Edgar Bergen, father of actress Candace Bergen, and his dummy, Charlie McCarthy.
She will then submerge to resurface for 5 minutes at 2-hour intervals, 10 minutes past the hour during the daylight hours, and from 30 minutes after sunset until 30 minutes before sunrise for a 7-day period. If contact has not been established during that period, she will return to Pearl Harbor. If there is contact between the landing party and the sunfish, or between Fertig, somehow, and the sunfish, we'll play that by ear.
He looked around the table.
Any comments, Mr. McCoy?
McCoy raised both hands palm upward.
Permission to speak, sir? Captain Robert B. Macklin said.
Certainly.
May I ask, sir, how you came to the 23rd, 24th December dates?
Show him, Jack, Pickering ordered. Colonel Stecker passed to Captain Macklin a sheet of typewriter paper.
Top secret. Special channel from Sinkpak, Hawaii. 1210, 9 December 42. 2. Supreme Headquarters, Sweepo, Brisbane. Eyes only. Brig Gen Fleming Pickering, USMC. Duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. Following personal from Sinkpak to Brig Gen Pickering, USMC. Dear Fleming. 1. Have been informed Sunfish will complete fueling and provisioning Espirito Santo by 1200 hours 10 December 1942. 2. Officer commanding Naval Air Transport Command Brisbane has been directed to make Coronado PB-2I aircraft available to you for travel Espirito Santo on arrival Brisbane, ETA 0500, 10 December 1942. 3. Please pass to all hands on behalf myself and Rear Admiral Daniel J. Wagham, Godspeed, good sailing, and good luck. Best personal regards, Chester.
End personal from Admiral Nimitz to Brigadier General Fertig.
By direction, Wagham, Rear Admiral USN. Top secret.
It's about 1,300 nautical miles from here to Espiritu Santo, Pickering said. Say 7 hours in a Coronado. If it arrives here when it's expected at 0500 tomorrow, I think we can reasonably expect to get in the air by noon. That would put us into Espiritu no later than 1800. We should be able to load everything aboard the Sunfish in an hour or so, and we should be able to sail at first light the day after tomorrow.
We? Colonel Stecker asked warily. I thought we discussed that.
Slip of the tongue, Jack. The Sunfish will sail with me standing on the pier at first light the day after tomorrow, which will be the 11th. It's 3,200 nautical miles from Espiritu Santo to Boston. Using Lewis's ballpark figures that the Sunfish can cruise on the surface at 15 knots, she should be able to make Mindanao in 10 days. That would be the 21st. To give us a little slack, I've scheduled her to be off Mindanao on the 23rd. He looked around the table.
Any questions?
Yes, sir? Captain Robert B. Macklin said.
Yes.
Nothing, sir, excuse me.
If you've got something to say, Captain, McCoy said, not very pleasantly, let's hear it.
Very well, Mr. McCoy, Macklin said. Since you have the responsibility for this mission, I was wondering if you have considered my physical condition, how that might adversely affect the mission.
I watched you paddle the rubber boat, Captain. It looked to me like you could handle that without much trouble. What exactly is your physical condition?
Macklin, Colonel Stecker said even less pleasantly, if you'd like, we can run you past a doctor and get an official report on your condition.
I was only thinking of the mission, Colonel, Macklin said. But I do have one question, sir.
Let's have it.
Has the OSS been kept up on how the mission is proceeding?
No, Pickering said, they haven't.
Do I have your permission to do so, sir?
I don't see why not.
Why don't we just tell them when we come back, McCoy said.
For some reason, McCoy doesn't like the idea of Macklin getting in touch with the OSS. I can't see what harm it would do, but I think I should indulge McCoy.
Don't worry about the OSS, Captain Macklin, Pickering said. As soon as the Sunfish puts out to sea, I'll see that Secretary Knox is notified. I'm sure he'll pass the word to Mr. Donovan.
Thank you, sir, Captain Robert B. Macklin said.
2. Water Lily Cottage, Brisbane, Australia, 2305 hours, 11 December 1942.
First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, USMCR, pulled the sheet of paper from the typewriter, laid it on the dining room table,
stood up, took a waterman's fountain pen from his shirt pocket, and scrawled his name at the bottom. Then he picked it up and read what had taken him the better part of an hour to write. Brisbane, Australia, 9 December 1942. Dear Ernie, Ed Sessions is going to the States the day after tomorrow and has promised to carry this with him. This will be the last letter for a while, as I've got a job to do someplace where there isn't mail service. That means you don't have to write either, as I wouldn't get it anyhow. I can't tell you where I'm going, and I don't know when I'll be back. Please don't put Ed on the spot by trying to get him to tell you. I can't see the necessity for all the secrecy, but Ed is an intelligence type, and they're all a little hysterical about secrets. If they could, intelligence types would classify the telephone book top secret. I'll be taking that Episcopal cross, or whatever it's called, you sent here with Ed with me. And the people going with me are first-rate Marines. Actually, I'm sort of looking forward to it. All those native girls in grass skirts and nothing else doing the hula hula and eating roasted pigs with apples in their mouths, etc. I was thinking a while ago that I met you 20th of November last year. That's just a little over a year, even if it seems like much longer. And I remembered that saying, it's better to have loved and lost than not have loved at all. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if something goes wrong, not that I think it's going to, I really think I'm still ahead of the game. I never thought I would be lucky enough to get to know somebody like you, much less have you as my girlfriend, and to even think that maybe you like me half as much as I like you. But let's face it, things sometimes do go wrong. If that happens, what I want you to do is get on with your life. I'm really grateful we had our 13 months. If it turns out that I do find myself sitting on a cloud playing a harp, that's the way the ball bounced. At least it will have happened doing something I'm good at, and that has to be done. A lot of people get killed doing stupid things like getting hit by a bus walking across a street. I know Pick will be around for you if something goes wrong, and to tell you the truth, if I had to pick a husband for you, he would be at the head of the list. Thanks for everything, baby. Love, Ken. He very carefully folded the letter in thirds, found an envelope, and wrote, K.R. McCoy, 1st Lieutenant, USMCR, in the upper left-hand corner. Miss Ernestine Sage, personal, in the center, inserted the letter, licked the adhesive flap with his tongue, and carefully sealed the envelope. He looked at the envelope, tapped it against his hand, and exhaled audibly. His eyes fell on the cupboard. He walked to it, opened it, and took out a bottle of famous grouse, put it to his lips, and took a healthy swallow. Then he walked out of the dining room, across the living room, and down the corridor to Ed Sessions' room. There was a crack of light under the door. McCoy knocked, waited for a response, and then opened the door and went inside. Sessions, in pajamas, was about to get into bed. He saw the envelope in McCoy's hand. "For Ernie?" McCoy nodded and handed it to him. "Thanks, Ed." Sessions shrugged.
"You all right, Ken?"
"Yeah, sure," McCoy said, and then asked, "You want to go somewhere and get a drink?"
"Don't tell me there's nothing here. I want to get out of here. I've been in that goddamn dining room since 4:30 this afternoon."
"The last thing in the world I want to do is go somewhere and get a drink. I was also in that goddamn dining room for hours. But he really wants some company. And this is the first time since I've known him that McCoy has ever asked me for something. I suspect it's one of the few times that Killer McCoy has ever asked anybody, except Ernie, to keep him company."
"Having a drink, or three, is the best suggestion I've heard all day," Ed Sessions said. "Have we got wheels? There's a jeep outside. Be right with you." "God is in his heaven, and all is right with the world," Ed Sessions said as he walked up to Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, at the bar of the Sweepo company-grade bachelor officer's quarters. "The U.S. Navy is nobly doing its duty, holding the bar in place with its elbows."
"I didn't expect to see you two in here," Lewis said. He did not seem especially happy to see them.
"I think he's had more than a couple," Sessions decided.
"We're slumming," Sessions said. "Actually, I was sort of looking for you," McCoy said.
"Oh, were you?" Lewis asked, somewhat coldly. "And are you going to tell me why, Mr. McCoy?"
The very careful pronunciation and exaggerated courtesy of the drunk, the belligerent drunk. Christ, why did McCoy decide to come here?
Well, you're both a swabby and an expert on submarines, McCoy said. I wanted to... He was interrupted by the barmaid.
Gentlemen?
Have you got any scotch whiskey?
You just got here, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't ask.
Are you trying to tell me you don't have any scotch?
In our last shipment from Class 6, there were 3 bottles. First, they take care of the big brass. Then they take care of the field-grade brass. Then they take care of the sergeants. The only people they take care of after us is the corporals and privates, and they aren't authorized any kind of hard whiskey. So what we have is rum, gin, and brandy.
In that case, my friend and I will have a glass of ice water, McCoy said. And while we're at it, give the sailor a glass of ice water, too. The barmaid's shrug indicated that the strange behavior of Yanks no longer came as a surprise to her. She produced 3 glasses with ice in them and a stainless steel pitcher of water. Thank you, McCoy said, and produced a quart bottle of famous grouse from a cloth bag. Say when, he ordered, as he began to pour into the first of the glasses. When he had finished and water was added, he raised his glass. To the United States Navy Submarine Corps, or whatever they call it.
I'll drink to that, Sessions said. Are you two trying to be cute? Lewis asked.
No, not at all, McCoy said. Lewis took a sip of his scotch.
You stole this from General Pickering, right? He asked.
He gave it to me, McCoy said. His words were, I was free to help myself to whatever I thought I needed, which is more or less what I wanted to talk to you about.
You found me?
Lewis said, with enough of an unpleasant tone in his voice to get through to McCoy. McCoy looked at him curiously.
Well, I figured you know how things are on submarines, and I know how chicken shit the Navy is about taking booze aboard.
You want to take some of that with you? Lewis interrupted. Is that what you're after?
I was thinking that if I'd been in the boondocks as long as Fertig and his people, a stiff shot of good whiskey would probably taste pretty good.
I don't think anyone is going to question anything you want to take aboard the Sunfish, Mr. McCoy.
Or the plane from here to Espirito Santo?
Or the plane. You are wrapped through me in the protective mantle of Sink Peck himself.
I was thinking about a case.
You want to take a case of Scotch whiskey with you?
Why not?
Indeed, why not?
May I suggest that you wrap it up so it won't be so obvious that you consider yourself above complying with regulations?
Sessions looked at McCoy and saw there was no smile on his face and that his eyes had turned into ice. And then McCoy relaxed as if he had just realized that Lewis was drunk and should not be held responsible.
That's already been done, McCoy said, in some of Koffler's plastic.
Then I see no problem at all, Lewis said.
Thanks, McCoy said.
Would you like to tell me what's bothering you, Lewis? Sessions asked.
It shows, does it? Lewis replied. That something's bothering me?
Has it to do with Macklin?
What do you think?
I think it's despicable what you did to him. I never thought I would see a naval officer so humiliated.
Am I missing something here? McCoy asked.
McCoy doesn't know, Sessions said.
I don't know what, McCoy asked.
Then I hastily offer my most humble and sincere apologies, Mr. McCoy, Lewis said. Until just now I thought it was your idea.
What the hell are you talking about?
McCoy said, and the ice was back in his voice and eyes.
It was General Pickering's idea, Sessions said. McCoy didn't know anything about it.
Oh, for Christ's sake, McCoy said. What didn't I know about, Ed?
Hart showed up here, Mr. McCoy. Knock off that Mr. McCoy shit, McCoy interrupted. I don't think you're funny.
5 minutes after Captain Macklin and I got here, Ken, Lewis said, Lieutenant Hart showed up here. He told Captain Macklin he had orders to stay with him until we were picked up to go to the terminal tomorrow morning and that Captain Macklin couldn't leave the BOQ or use the telephone without Colonel Stecker's express permission.
Shit, McCoy said.
I was hoping the bastard would go over the hill.
I think Pickering was one step ahead of you on that, Sessions said.
Right after the meeting broke up and Lewis and Macklin left, and you went to take a leak, Pickering told Moore to relieve Hart in the dungeon. Then he told Stecker to call Hart and tell him to go to the BOQ, sit on Macklin and see that he was at the terminal at 0900 tomorrow.
You don't really think Bob Macklin would have purposely missed the plane, do you?
Lewis challenged Sessions. McCoy drained his drink and made another one. The bartender has just gone off duty, he said. If you guys want any more, pour your own.
Because he's Annapolis, you mean?
Sessions replied.
Yes, I do. That sleazy bastard is capable of anything, including missing a shipment, Sessions said.
I was sort of hoping he would, McCoy said matter-of-factly. Christ knows, I don't want to take him with me. Actually, I was counting on him figuring out some way to get out of going. I wrote my girl that I was taking good Marines with me. Sessions chuckled.
Once again, the wise general officer outwits the junior officer, he said.
I don't suppose it would do any good if I said I think you two are giving Macklin the short end of the stick, Lewis asked. I trust him about half as far as I can throw him, McCoy said. Pickering said he hopes I don't have to shoot him, but he didn't tell me I can't. Does that answer your question?
I wonder if Lewis is capable, drunk or sober, of fully understanding that. That both Pickering and McCoy were seriously discussing the benefits and drawbacks of eliminating, by shooting, an obstacle to the mission who happens to be named Macklin.
Has it occurred to you, Ken, that there are people who aren't like you? People who are afraid? Lewis said, his tone of voice now conciliatory and reasonable.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? McCoy said.
I'm trying to suggest that Bob Macklin is afraid of what's liable to happen on this mission. He's trying hard to get himself under control, and if he hasn't, that's not really his fault. Some people seem to be born with courage, but some people aren't.
And you don't think I'm scared? Just between you and me, I'm scared shitless about this mission, McCoy said. And then, his voice turning incredulous.
Did you really think I think it's a lot of fun?
You don't act as if you're afraid. An officer's first duty is to take care of his men. Don't tell me it's any different on a submarine.
Meaning what? Lewis challenged.
If I look scared, then Zimmerman and Koffler get scared, okay? The one thing I can't afford is to have Zimmerman and Koffler thinking they're in the deep shit because their officer is pissing his pants.
He looked at Lewis for a moment and then warmed to his subject.
Or are you trying to tell me the officers on a submarine don't break their asses to make sure the White Hats don't see how scared they are?
What makes you so sure submarine officers are frightened?
They're either scared or mentally retarded, McCoy said.
Don't bullshit me, Lewis. I've been on two of the goddamn things. The worst part of the McKean raid was getting there and back in that steel underwater coffin. And the worst part of the Buka operation was getting there in a submarine. When I saw the Goonie Bird coming in to take us off of Buka, the first thing I thought was, thank Christ I don't have to get back in that fucking submarine.
Some of them aren't frightened, Lewis argued.
Okay. In any group of 10 officers, you can count on 2 being stupid. You can also count on those 2 getting you in trouble. But you were scared. You're too smart not to have been scared, McCoy said. But you were obviously a good enough officer to keep the White Hats from seeing it. Otherwise, they would have thrown your ass out of the submarines.
The point Mr. McCoy is making, Lieutenant Lewis, Sessions said, is that what he has against Captain Macklin is not that Captain Macklin has far less than the normal issue of testicles, but that Captain Macklin considers his first duty is to take care of Captain Macklin and fuck anybody else.
That's a pretty harsh judgment, wouldn't you say? I associate myself fully, Lieutenant Lewis, with Mr. McCoy's somewhat obscene, but right on the fucking money, assessment of Captain Macklin. I've seen the son of a bitch at work.
What would you two say if I told you that I never spent a minute in a submarine that I wasn't afraid? Lewis asked, and was immediately horrified to hear what he had blurted.
Neither McCoy nor Sessions seemed surprised to hear the confession.
Did you let the White Hat see it? McCoy asked.
I hope not, Lewis said. Take it from me, you didn't. If you had, the other officers would have seen to it that you never went down in one again.
Jesus Christ. Can he be right? May I ask a question, gentlemen? Sessions asked. What the hell are we arguing about?
Who knows, McCoy said. Who cares? Slide the bottle over here, will you?
3. Office of the Director, Office of Strategic Services, National Institute of Health Building, Washington, D.C. 0930 hours, 13 December, 1942. What could have been a smile crossed the lips of L. Stanford Morissette, Deputy Director, Special Projects, Office of Strategic Services, as he read the message contained in the manila folder with Top Secret stamped across it.
One moment, please, Colonel, if you don't mind, he said to Colonel F. L. Rickaby, Deputy Chief, USMC Office of Management Analysis. I believe this should be brought to the attention of the Director.
My time is your time, Mr. Morissette, Rickaby said.
Morissette picked up the receiver of a red telephone, one of three telephones on his desk, and dialed 0.
Mo, Bill, he said. Colonel Rickaby of the Marine Corps is in my office with something I thought you'd like to see. Can you spare us a minute?
The reply of the Director was obviously in the affirmative, for Morissette stood up as he replaced the red handset in its cradle and gestured toward the door.
He's right down the corridor, Colonel, he said. I think I should warn you the Director thinks the savages of yore who killed messengers delivering bad news had the right idea.
In my line of work you get used to that, Rickaby said.
Morissette opened Colonel William J. Donovan's door without knocking and waved Rickaby in ahead of him.
Colonel Donovan, he said, I believe you know Colonel Rickaby?
Yes, of course,
Donovan said, rising behind his desk and putting out his hand.
I see the chickens, Fritz. Well deserved and long overdue.
Thank you, sir.
What have you got for me?
This, sir. Captain Houghton, Secretary Knox's assistant, hand-carried this to me this morning with instructions to make it available to you.
He handed him the manila folder stamped Top Secret. Donovan waved the two of them into the two red leather chairs in front of his desk, sat down, and opened the folder. Top Secret. Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, 1515 hours, 11 December, 42. Eyes only. The Secretary of the Navy, Washington, D.C. Commander-in-Chief, Pacific Pearl Harbor, TH. Via special channel, duplication forbidden, original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. 1. Radio from Brig Gen Fleming Pickering, USMCR, reports USN Sunfish departed Espirito Santo 0505 local time, 11 December, 42, carrying aboard Fertig contact team. Further details will be furnished as available. Supreme Commander Sweepo has been advised. 2. Brig Gen Pickering desires contents this message be furnished Colonel F.L. Rickaby, USMC, Office of Management Analysis immediately, and states he has no objection to this information being made available to Director, Office of Strategic Services. A. Personnel of Fertig contact team are as follows. McCoy, Kenneth R., First Lieutenant, USMCR. 489-657, Officer in Command. Zimmerman, Ernest W., Gunnery Sergeant, 189-09, USMC, Deputy Commander. Koffler, Stephen M., Staff Sergeant, USMC, 504-883, USMC, Radio Operator. B. In addition, Brig Gen Pickering stated Sunfish also carried aboard Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, as personal representative, Admiral Nimitz. Lewis will not go ashore. C. In addition, Brig Gen Fertig stated Captain Robert B. Macklin, USMC of OSS, quote, Operation Windmill, end quote, with which he is not familiar, is also aboard Sunfish and may go ashore as observer. The decision will be made at time of landing by Lieutenant McCoy based on his assessment at that time of Macklin's potential value and or threat to mission. D. Captain Edward Sessions, USMC, will depart Brisbane for Washington, D.C. via Pearl Harbor and San Francisco, 0900, 12 December, 42, and is prepared to brief interested personnel on arrival. By direction, Brig Gen Pickering, USMCR. Han, Major, Signal Corps, USA. Top Secret. Donovan smiled as he began to read the message. By the time he was finished, the smile was visibly strained.
First rate, Fritz, he said. We're moving.
Yes, sir.
This Lieutenant McCoy and the others, are you familiar with them?
Yes, sir, they're assigned to us. Donovan waited until he was sure that he had gotten all he was going to get from Rickaby without prompting, then made a "come on" gesture with his right hand. Lieutenant McCoy and Gunny Zimmerman made the Makin Island raid with Captain Roosevelt, sir. Sergeant Koffler spent some time on Buka with the Australian Coast Watchers, sir. They're experienced in this type of operation.
I felt sure General Pickering would select the best available men, Donovan said.
I think he did, sir, Rickaby replied.
You are not familiar with Operation Windmill, Fritz?
No, sir.
Our fault, obviously. Sorry. We should have made sure you and General Pickering were brought in on that. It is, of course, simply the name we assigned to the Fertig operation.
Yes, sir.
I would be grateful when Captain Sessions arrives if he could brief Mr. Morissette and myself.
I'll see to it that he does, sir.
Have you got anything else for me, Fritz?
No, sir, that's about it.
Well, thank you for bringing this so promptly to my attention.
My pleasure, sir.
Well then, Fritz, I won't keep you. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Mo, stick around a minute, will you? Donovan said.
Thank you, Colonel Rickaby, Morissette said, and offered his hand.
Good morning, gentlemen, Rickaby said.
Donovan waited until Rickaby had closed the door after him, and then turned to Morissette.
What would you say are the chances that the President has already seen, or will soon see, that goddamn special channel?
100%, Bill. If Frank Knox doesn't show it, hasn't already shown it to him, I'm sure he'll get it back-channel, Nimitz to Leahy to FDR.
I don't like to be sandbagged like that. I'll burn Pickering's ass for this.
For what?
What do you mean, for what? Did you read that?
General Pickering, in compliance with his orders, is making every reasonable effort to include our guy on the mission. He's on the submarine. If he doesn't go ashore, it will be because the officer in charge decides that his presence would pose a threat to the mission.
Our guy is a captain. This McCoy is only a lieutenant. Our guy should be the officer in command.
This one made the Makin Island raid with Roosevelt's son, Morissette said. And if you think Pickering hasn't made sure that FDR knows that, you're underestimating him again.
Meaning?
You'll have a hard time convincing FDR that Pickering's sandbagging you by putting this lieutenant in charge. This lieutenant is a Marine raider, and Marine raiders generally, and especially one who was on the Makin raid with young Roosevelt, are the apples of FDR's eye.
You don't really expect me to take this lying down.
Are you asking for advice?
Yeah, advise me.
Make your peace with Pickering. Donovan looked at him for a long moment.
Thank you, Mo, he said. Is there anything else?
Morissette shook his head, no. Part 15. 1. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 18:45 hours, 23 December, 1942. It was raining, and Captain James B. Weston, USFIP, stumbled while climbing and nearly slipped off the rain-slick, ladder-like stairs leading to the quarters of Brigadier General Wendell W. Fertig. He managed not to drop his Thompson submachine gun, but his campaign hat fell into the darkness, and he had to climb back down the stairs and look for it on his hands and knees under the house. Finally, he gained the porch and walked down it to the door. Hanging over the door as a blackout device was a piece of canvas, reclaimed by United States forces in the Philippines after 6 months of service to the Japanese on a captured U.S. Army ton-and-a-half truck. Someone remembered reading that the light of a candle could be seen from an aircraft on a dark night for 7 miles. It sounded a bit incredible, but Headquarters USFIP was in no position to put their incredulity to the test, and General Fertig had ordered blackout curtains over all doors and windows after nightfall, whenever lanterns or candles were alight inside. Weston pushed aside the blackout curtain and stepped inside. The only light came from one kerosene lamp and 3 homemade lamps consisting of burning wicks in the necks of Coca-Cola bottles filled with coconut oil. But Weston's eyes, accustomed to the absolute blackness of the night, took a moment to adjust. After they adjusted, he saw General Fertig behind his desk, and 2 of the 3 members of the USFIP signal section, Second Lieutenant Robert Ball, signal officer, and Sergeant Ignacio Lamadrid, chief radio operator, sitting on rattan chairs.
Ball and La Madrid held Coca-Cola bottles containing the Getting Better All the Time USFIP brewed beer, and four bottles of beer, three of them empty, were on Fertig's desk.
The cocktail hour, to which I was not invited, Weston thought.
You sent for me, sir? He asked.
As our intelligence officer and, of course, as a Marine, Captain Weston, Fertig said, I'm sure you are a veritable cornucopia of arcane information vis-a-vis naval lore.
Sir?
I don't think anybody but the general was invited to his cocktail hour.
Lieutenant Ball, Sergeant La Madrid, and myself have all been wondering what the Navy expects to find in heaven, Fertig said.
Is he plastered?
I don't think I understand, sir.
I'm disappointed, Fertig said. I was hoping the answer to that intriguing conundrum would immediately occur to you.
Sorry, sir, I just don't understand. What occurred to me was that what a sailor would hope to find would be a bevy of naked beauties and real cold beer, but that doesn't seem to fit. Show that to Captain Weston, would you please, Lieutenant Ball?
Ball handed Weston a sheet of paper, its carbon paper characters hard to read in the dim light. Use what Navy will find in heaven as new SimSub code.
That came in about an hour ago, Lieutenant Ball said.
A strong signal, sir, Sergeant La Madrid amplified, and it was repeated 2-3 times from both Australia and Pearl Harbor.
Use what Navy, Weston read haltingly, will find in heaven as new SimSub code. Use what Navy will find in heaven. What the hell does that mean?
Jesus, that sounds familiar,
Jim Weston thought, and then felt a chill.
If the Army and the Navy, he intoned softly, ever look on heaven's scenes, they will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines.
Bingo, Lieutenant Ball said. That has to be it.
The Marine hymn, Weston said. How long will it take you to decrypt the message using that?
About 10 minutes, Ball said, after we get the message.
That's all you've got? You don't have the message?
That's all we have, Sergeant La Madrid said. I'm sure there will be more, Fertig said. And while we're waiting, Captain Weston, would you care for a beer?
Yes, thank you, sir.
The signal officer of USFIP, the intelligence officer, his deputy, and the commanding general had considerably more trouble decrypting the number blocks of message 2 when it arrived 2 hours later. The highest number used was 53. It was therefore logical to presume that the phrase to use for simple substitution contained 53 characters. Streets guarded by U.S. Marines. This was 25 characters, although it was possible that the phrase would be repeated twice. They could, Lieutenant Ball said, come back to this later if nothing else seemed to work. Streets are guarded by United States Marines was 38 characters, too short by itself and too long if the phrase was to be duplicated. These streets are guarded by United States Marines was 41 characters, also too short and too long. The streets are guarded by U.S. Marines was 31 characters, also too short by itself, but if used twice, not too much longer, 62 characters versus the required 53, it was worthy of further consideration. Perhaps the extra 9 characters in the repeated phrase would not prove to be important. Finally, the complete phrase from the Marine hymn, as precisely as it could be remembered by Weston and Second Lieutenant Percy L. Everly, was tried. They will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines. It was precisely 53 characters. It had to be the substitution phrase. The number blocks of message 2 were decrypted. They made sense. Not very much, but some sense. Lieutenant Percy L. Everly had a stab at it.
Lily, who the hell is L-I-L-L-E? And Ernie, now that has to be Zimmerman. We'll eat beans. What the hell does that mean? 30 miles south. That could be, probably is south, but south of what? This Murning.
this morning.
Sir? Sergeant Lamadrid said. That's Liller, with an R, sir, before the and.
Killer, Lieutenant Everly said. God damn, Lamadrid, you're not as dumb as you look. Killer and Ernie, that's what it is.
Killer and Ernie, meaning the people you knew, Lieutenant Everly? General Fertig asked.
Yes, sir. China Marine, sir. Ernie Zimmerman and Killer McCoy.
We'll eat beans 30 miles south this morning, Weston thought aloud. The key words are beans and 30 miles south. What the hell can that mean?
Beans, 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 lima beans, string beans. Isn't there a village called St. Rose of Lima or something like that? Ball asked.
Yes, there is, General Fertig said.
And there is also a village called Boston on the East Coast. Boston baked beans. Weston, for God's sake, I hope you still have our one National Geographic Society map of this island.
Yes, sir. I suggest you bring it, Fertig said.
30 miles south of St. Rose of Lima is 50 miles from nowhere up here in the hills, Captain Weston said, using his finger as a pointer on the tattered map. 30 miles south of Boston is this little bump sticking into the ocean.
I believe they call that a promontory, Captain Weston, Fertig said. How far is that from here?
Weston measured it with a scrap of paper applied to the legend on the National Geographic Society map.
60 miles, sir. If we are to accept that these two people will be eating beans there this morning, we have to define morning, Fertig said. One of two things is true. They are already on Mindanao and are suggesting this as a rendezvous point, or they will land there, presumably from a submarine. I think I bet on the latter. If this assumption is correct, and we further assume a submarine would prefer to surface no longer than is absolutely necessary, I would suggest morning would mean at first light.
My God, Ball said. Do you really think someone's coming this morning?
Are there any arguments to my assumptions? Fertig asked.
There were none.
The next question would then seem to be, gentlemen, what are we going to do about it? There is no way we could get anyone from here, you said, 60 miles, Weston?
Yes, sir.
No way we can get anyone to this point, Fertig went on. 60 miles distant from here by first light. The possibility exists that whoever these people are, they will attempt to make contact with USFIP, fail to do so, and withdraw.
General, sir? Excuse me?
Sergeant Lamadrid said.
Yes, Sergeant. I have a motorcycle, General, sir.
Shit, Lieutenant Percy L. Lewis said. I forgot about that. Can we get the motorcycle down to the road at night? Fertig asked.
More important, is it running? Weston asked. Do we have gas for it? Will it make it for 60 miles?
It doesn't have a muffler. It'll call every Jap in 10 miles, Everly said.
It has a gasoline, Sergeant Lamadrid said, and it will go the distance if the oil does not exhaust itself. I will conduct it with great care.
You're not going, Sergeant, Fertig said. I can't afford to lose my radio operator.
I'll go, Weston said immediately.
Can you ride a motorcycle, Mr. Weston? Lieutenant Everly asked.
It can't be that hard, Weston said. It's only a bicycle with a motor, right? I can ride a bike.
I'll go, Everly said. I can ride a motorcycle.
You'll both go, General Fertig said. You will both attempt to make your presence known to the submarine, if there is a submarine. If there is a submarine, Captain Weston will remain on the beach to do whatever has to be done, and Lieutenant Everly will get back on the motorcycle to establish contact with the patrol, which Captain Hedges will be leading from here, and lead it to the rendezvous point. If there is no submarine, Lieutenant Everly will meet Captain Hedges, who will then return the patrol here. In that circumstance, you will have to get back here by yourself, Weston.
Aye, aye, sir.
We will have to establish right now the path of the patrol, and Everly will have to memorize it. It would be best, Weston, if you were unaware of the patrol's route.
Aye, aye, sir.
The thinking behind that isn't hard to figure out. There's a very good chance that I'll be captured. If I don't know the patrol's route, then I can't tell the Japanese no matter what they do to me, Weston thought.
When the patrol leaves, we will relocate headquarters USFIP, Fertig said. If this maneuver proves successful, I will get word of the new location to you. If it doesn't, it won't matter whether you know where we are or not.
Yeah, Lieutenant Everly said thoughtfully, and quickly corrected himself. Yes, sir.
Captain Weston, would you please give my compliments to Captain Hedges and ask him to join me?
Aye, aye, sir.
Sergeant La Madrid, would you please instruct Lieutenant Everly in the operation of your motorcycle, and then, using the new Marine HIM substitution code, transmit the following message to both Australia and Pearl Harbor. We'll bring the hot dogs. Fertig.
Sir?
Weston said.
What is it?
May I suggest the message be, we'll try to bring the hot dogs?
Oh, ye of little faith, Fertig said.
Send, we'll bring the hot dogs, Sergeant La Madrid.
Yes, sir,
Sergeant La Madrid said. 2. Approximately 30 miles south of Boston, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 0501 hours, 24 December, 1942. It was raining. It had alternated between raining and drizzling all night. The road was slippery and they spilled 5 times, but suffered nothing more than damaged egos, and Christ only knew how much mud and slime forced into the actions of their weapons. United States forces in the Philippines, having decreed a state of martial law, had issued an order that all road signs that might be useful to the Japanese be destroyed, removed, moved, obliterated, or otherwise rendered unusable. The Filipinos had carried out the order with an efficiency that disheartened and frustrated Captain Weston. Since they couldn't go into Boston and start counting from there, he needed road markers to tell them how far they were south of Boston. The next-to-last spill occurred when Weston spotted a nearly concealed concrete mile marker the Filipinos had missed. He applied the brakes too suddenly when he wanted a closer look. Using mile marker 19 as a reference point, they continued 10 miles farther down what had been Highway 1, and then, hiding the motorcycle 100 yards off the road, in a spot where Weston was convinced it would next be seen by archaeologists in the year 1999, they proceeded on foot through the rain-soaked jungle until they heard, but did not see, the surf crashing on the beach. They then proceeded at approximately 100 yards distance from the beach, and the Japanese patrols that might be on the beach, until they reached the tip of what Weston would never forget was called a promontory. Not without effort, they climbed the tallest trees they could find that might offer a view of the shoreline and ocean, then climbed down again when they could see nothing but other trees. Everly fell the last 20 feet and sprained his ankle. This would pose problems when the time came for him to return to the motorcycle, presuming he could find the motorcycle. Then, with 100 yards separating them, if there was a patrol, one of them might stand a chance of escaping, they crawled through the steaming slime to the end of the vegetation and there took up their vigil. To protect them, both against an inadvertent discharge in case the trigger snagged in the vegetation, Captain Weston had carried his weapon without a round ready to be chambered and fired when he pulled the trigger. Now, his heart leaping, he pulled back the bolt on the Thompson, rolled over on his back, and prepared to fire at whatever was coming through the jungle at him.
"Easy, Mr. Weston,"
Everly hissed.
"Easy does it. You scared the shit out of me. Did you see the Japs?"
Weston's heart jumped. He shook his head no.
"Four of them headed north," Everly said. "A corporal and 3 privates.
"They're gone?" Everly nodded.
"Then what's the problem?" "There's 2 people out there in a black rubber boat,"
Everly said. Weston looked. Visibility was very poor and the sea very wide, but eventually he saw 2 men dressed in black in a small black rubber boat, their backs bent to lower their silhouette, paddling slowly through the black water toward the shore.
"Jesus Christ! The Japs may come back or they may not," Everly said. "Your call, Mr. Weston."
"What do you mean, my call?"
"Do you want to take the chance that they won't come back? If they do come back, they're going to see the boat for sure.
If they haven't already seen it and already started somewhere where they can report it, they didn't have a radio that I could see.
Weston thought the situation over.
I don't think they're just marching down the beach, Everly went on. A truck must have put them off